Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. After Russia launched its full-scale war on Ukraine, new opportunities opened up in Central Asia, a region where Russia had dominated since the last years of the Tsarist Empire. With Russia's attention and resources diverted to Ukraine, many countries that had played marginal roles in Central Asian foreign policy rushed to fill vacuums left by Russia. Some of these countries have gone further, signing deals to modernize Central Asia's transportation, energy, and digital infrastructure, and pledging investments of tens of billions of dollars. The Kremlin has noticed. Russia's moving to shore up its connections to this region where it once had unassailable influence. And Russia appears to be enjoying some success. Recent agreements seem to be tying the Central Asian states closer to Russia in key areas and for many years to come. To discuss all this, I am joined by Asel Tutumlu, a lecturer at the International Relations and Political Science Department at the Near East University in Cyprus, Timur Umarov, a fellow at the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center in Berlin, and Francis Olmos, senior researcher in Central Asian Affairs at Spain's Geopol 21 Center and also a research fellow at the London-based Foreign Policy Center. Thank you all for being here today. Fran, let's start with you. Can you give me an overview? What's Russia been doing lately to try to solidify its ties and its influence in Central Asia?
Well, I mean, since, like you pointed in your introduction, since the war in Ukraine, there's been some renewed efforts by Russia to engage with Central Asian countries. We've seen lots of high-level trips in the last couple of years of from Putin to the prime ministers to other ministers, speakers of the Duma, Senate, and so on, to Central Asia. So they're starting to look at different deals they've been signing. There's a couple of areas specifically which they've been very keen to get on board, related to energy, for instance, related to transit. So they still want to be present in the region. I mean, of course, you know, because of the war in Ukraine, it's not like Russia has an unlimited number of partners. So the ones that they currently have, they want to cement their links with them and their relationship with them. But yeah, mostly I would say related to a large extent to energy and transit, but with high level visits for the last couple of years since 2022.
Okay, thank you. Let's look at some of these, especially these energy deals, which are really interesting to follow. So what can you tell me about the energy deals Russia's been signing and with who in Central Asia specifically?
Sure. Well, actually, we can, I think, divide the Russian involvement in energy deals in three different dimensions. One is related to electricity. Another would be related to nuclear energy and nuclear stations, construction of nuclear stations. And another one is the thermal and hydropower plants. And I think Russia has really stepped up the efforts in going in all of these three dimensions. So, for example, with Kazakhstan, we have had electricity supplies shortages, as well as Uzbekistan, and Timur can probably talk about more about it. So Russia has been compensating the deficit, and also it's started to export electricity since 2022. In 2023, for example, it reached 4.7 billion kilowatt of electricity that came from Russia. A lot of this deficit was blamed on mining, crypto mining in Kazakhstan, an industry that has pretty much diminished in its importance. But nonetheless, we still do have energy shortage, electricity shortages. And then we can look at the when we talk about thermal and hydropower plants. Kazakhstan and Russia have agreed to. To the construction of three thermal power plants in Uskominogorsk, Simei, and Kokshetau. Unfortunately, they are coal mined and they're coal built, so coal fired thermal plants. So it's relatively old technology, which undermines the transition of the country towards the green energy. But nonetheless, these agreements have been already signed. And then we have the nuclear power plants constructions, which are happening in, or about to happen, let's say, in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. In Uzbekistan, I think it's a set deal, but in Kazakhstan, we still have the intrigue of whether or not Rosatomprom is going to win the contract and whether or not the nuclear power plants are actually going to be built, because the referendum has been announced on October 6th in Kazakhstan to decide whether or not the country needs nuclear power plant. And then once it's decided, yes or no, then several companies, international companies, have already submitted the bids for the construction, including South Korea, France, Japan, and Russia. So we are yet to see what will happen in that area. Russia obviously is involved in construction or wants to be involved a bit more in construction of hydropower plants in Tajikistan, and it is also building a small reactor in Uzbekistan as well.
Okay, thank you. Tamura, let's go to Uzbekistan, you know, and please also touch on the nuclear thing, but I want to start with gas. It was only a few years ago that Uzbekistan was exporting gas to Russia, and that situation is totally reversed now. Is that true?
It's totally true. Uzbekistan's economy is growing, and Uzbekistan's population has been growing. So Uzbekistan today needs much more energy than ever before. Also, as Asel rightly pointed out, Uzbekistan has agreements with China to export gas there in 10 billion cubic meters every year. So it means that the amount of natural gas that is needed for internal market is growing. And in addition to that, Uzbekistan has responsibilities to send this natural gas to China. So in this situation, Uzbekistan has faced crisis. Last winter was the biggest one when people didn't have heating in the capital of Uzbekistan, in Tashkent, although I should say that the rest of the country has already got used to not having heating, central heating provided by the government during the winter season. But Tashkent is a spoiled one here. And Tashkent, people in Tashkent were shocked when it happened. And they literally sometimes would have to burn fire outside of their houses and homes and to cook something or get warm. So that was a big politically important moment for Uzbekistan to look at what is happening in the gas production market. And obviously, it created political consequences for people who were responsible for the situation. The mayor of the mayor at that moment of Tashkent, Jahangir Ortiqxo'jayev, was fired from his position. There were even rumors that he will be put in jail. However, it did not become a reality. And that actually, the whole situation pushed Uzbekistan to find new solution. And solution was found in relationship with Russia. Russia right now has a surplus of gas that it previously, before the full-scale invasion, used to sell to European countries. But now it obviously cannot. So it has a lot to offer to not big, but still substantial market of Central Asian countries. And this is what is happening. So I would say that the fact that Uzbekistan now depends more on Russia when it comes to gas, it's not the marker of Uzbekistan being more dependent on Russia or being more pro-Russian. It is a marker of Uzbekistan being pragmatic and finding solutions out of the situation. And in my view, the ideal scenario for Uzbekistan would be to buy those 10 cubic meters from Russia and to sell them to China so that it has some surplus for the domestic market.
Before we leave this point, this is an interesting issue that you raised here. One, I was hoping for the benefit of the audience, if you could talk a little bit about the fact that, I mean, Uzbekistan has gas reserves, estimated gas reserves of 1 trillion cubic meters, right? It was a gas exporting country. It was just a few years ago, six, 7 years ago, that President Shavkat Mirziyoyev was talking about upping gas output to 60 billion cubic meters a year. It's gone in totally the opposite direction. I think last year they didn't even quite produce 47 billion cubic meters of gas. Now, am I wrong that the major two foreign companies that are working gas fields in Uzbekistan right now are Gazprom and Lukoil, Russia's Gazprom and Lukoil?
No, you're not wrong.
What does that say about gas production? It's really weird that they have the gas. Years ago, they knew that they were going to need the gas. And yet, production, instead of production increasing, it's gradually been decreasing.
So the situation on the gas market in Uzbekistan is tricky. On the one hand, Uzbekistan has a potentially big amount of reserves. And especially when we look at the papers, especially when we look at the statistics, it looks like Uzbekistan should be able not only to provide the gas for the local population for domestic market, but also to export it freely. However, in reality, the situation looks different. The biggest resources, the biggest reserves are not producing as much gas as they used to before. Most of the reserves have been under production for quite some times, they are not as rich as they used to be. So finding new potentially big reserves, Uzbekistan need to spend additional money on that, and also considering the huge amount of corruption in this market, and sometimes even it's impossible to understand who in reality controls some of the flows of money in that particular sphere. Radio Free Liberty had a very important investigations in this market last year, where your colleagues showed that Gazprom, through some of the offshore companies, actually controls a majority of the biggest reserves in Uzbekistan's gas production system. So the reality that we live in is that the resources that Uzbekistan possesses are under control of specific influential people inside Uzbekistan's government. And for them, it's much more preferable to sell the resources outside of the country to get foreign currency as a paycheck. And it's not preferable to sell it on the domestic market. And this is something that the government is trying to take under control. However, considering that some of the people who control it are themselves working the government, it's not an easiest task.
Okay, thank you. Asel, let's talk about gas a little bit in Kazakhstan too. Now, Uzbekistan is signed on for a contract that they're, even as of next year, they might purchase up to 11 billion cubic meters of gas. But in 2023, the major Central Asian importer of Russian gas was actually Kazakhstan, right? 7.25 BCM of gas that they imported from Russia. And Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan have both signed contracts this year for gas supplies from Russia that run until 2024. It wasn't so long ago that Kazakhstan was also saying, we're going to export 10 billion cubic meters of gas to China, and then saying, no, we're going to up that. It's going to be 20 billion, and we're going to gasify the whole system. What happened?
I think it's also linked to the idea that maybe we do, instead of developing gas and or pumping it or flaring it, Kazakhstan decided to go with a nuclear power plant in Balkhash. So basically, the situation is also complicated, as Timur already mentioned, particularly because the majority of gas has been pumped up. We do have enough gas production, although it decreased, I think, this year. But nonetheless, we do have enough gas production. It's just the majority of it is being pumped back into the wells because of the high sulfur and other accompanying gases. So we do need to have a facility that can potentially really make it consumable. And in order to do that, we do need facilities for that. The government is trying to create one right now. It's been in the plans for years, and it is now trying to engage international investors to also pitch into the project to produce gas that can be then moved around the country. But in the meantime, before these things are actually done, some gas needs to be imported from Russia. Again, here we have many potential benefits, lucrative benefits for the people who make these decisions, because that gas can then potentially be exported to China, the surplus of it. So that's why it's a relatively lucrative deal for the regime in charge. And in the meantime, before we can process our gas to transfer it around the country, that's also a very good short-term solution for the state.
Okay, thank you. Fran, there's another aspect to this too, that, you know, not only is Russia getting a new market to sort of replace, I suppose, its losses in Europe from not being able to ship gas to Europe, but, you know, Central Asia, certainly since Mirziyoyev came to power in Uzbekistan, they've kind of been, you know, I mean, they've been becoming closer together all the time. They've strengthened ties amongst themselves. But Russia's strong entry into the Central Asian gas market has displaced the logical supplier of gas to some of these Central Asian countries. Could you talk a little bit about what happened to Turkmenistan?
Indeed. I mean, we can say that from in this game of the gas, I mean, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan are winners in their region, and also Kyrgyzstan with the long-term deal. So they can have the gas for their own domestic needs, to meet those domestic needs. But there's clearly a loser, which in this case is Turkmenistan, which logic, but as we know, when it comes to Turkmenistan and also geopolitics, logic never the answer, would say that it would be them supplying the gas. And, you know, in 2022, 2023, they reached deals with Kazakhstan, with Uzbekistan, to supply small amounts, but around up to 2 BCM, give or take, to these two countries, as to start, you know, for the winter period where they really want the gas. Now, what happened also, I think there was a couple of things. First of all, I think the Uzbeks didn't get a great experience from the gas they got from Turkmenistan, as the winter in 2022, 2023 was quite harsh, and supplies were interrupted from Turkmenistan. Reportedly, it's because they were using low-quality antifreeze, although, of course, the government just blamed it on the cold wave that was in the region. And Turkmenistan ended up sending trucks with LNG, with liquefied natural gas, to kind of make up for it. So, of course, Uzbekistan did get a great experience from that. And then Russia came into the picture. So they're supplying gas to now these both two countries. I think the latest plans are to supply up to 10, 11 BCMs to Uzbekistan, and also a number to Kazakhstan. Now, of course, this is undercutting Turkmenistan, and it's reducing its already reduced market for exports, because, I mean, right now, most of the gas they export is to China, and then now they have their swap deals they have with Azerbaijan. They're getting one with Iraq that's still not underway, and also they're working with Iran. But still, like, the logical markets, export routes, now they're being overtaken by Russia. And there's not much that Ashgabat can do about it. You know, Moscow has all the cars, or most of the cars here. But the situation, you know, if it's not great, it can always get worse. And, you know, there's reports that Russia will end up, or the intentions are, to end up exporting to using the pipelines of the Central Asia China pipeline to pump their own gas to China through that. So, I mean, that's still not been realized. But if that happens, then that would not only be a competition for Turkmenistan in Central Asia, but to its own exporter. Then China comes to the picture, so it's quite complicated, and let's see what happens there. But definitely, well, there's some winners in the region, you know, because they like to more say it's pragmatic reasons, and that's all very well. There's a clear loser in the sense that it's Turkmenistan that's losing potential markets, also at a time where they're, you know, they really need them. So I think, the role that Russia is playing there is quite interesting, and but there's not much that Ashgabat can do while the benefits are going into Russia. And then, of course, Russia is purchasing still Turkmen gas. I think the latest deal that was signed in 2019 goes up to 2024, so this year, which they were buying around 5 BCM the last couple of years before the invasion. They reached, I think, in 2021 up to 10. It was quite a lot, but they don't need this gas, right? So, because first of all, they, you know, they have the problem with Europe and they don't need the gas. Now, some of this gas could be making it back to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan as part of the Russia deals with these two countries. So it's quite a convoluted scenario, but I think the clear loser is Turkmenistan. And let's see what happens if Russia keeps on buying gas from them, and even if they do, it's still a bit of a token amount, and they might even continue to export that. So it's quite a situation that we got there.
Okay, thank you. And I should mention that under that old philosophy of divide and conquer, this Russia selling gas to Central Asia kind of served two purposes, because it does surely create some hard feelings on the part of Turkmen officials who are hoping to export to their neighbors. A reminder: we're talking about Russian power play in Central Asia, and my guests are Timur Umarov, a fellow at the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center in Berlin; Francis Olmos, a senior researcher in Central Asian affairs at Spain's Geopol 21 Center, and also a research fellow at the London-based Foreign Policy Center; and Asel Tutumlu, a lecturer at the International Relations and Political Science Department at the Near East University in Cyprus. Let's talk atomic energy for just a second here, too, because this is another thing. This is a long-term commitment on both the part of the Central Asians and the Russians. Let's go to first with Uzbekistan, because they actually have a contract and they're going to start building this, although it's a very unusual nuclear power plant they're building. Is this true, Timur?
Yeah, it is unusual. I'm not a big expert on nuclear energy, but as far as I understand, this is the so-called small nuclear reactor that Russia is proposing to build in Uzbekistan in Jizakh, if I'm not mistaken. And the, you know, uniqueness of this project is that these kinds of reactors have never been built by Rosatom before. I think there were test reactors somewhere on the northern part of Russia. However, there were no actually working reactors at the moment. So it seems like Rosatom wants to try something new and try it on the territory of Uzbekistan, which is not something that sounds very as a good plan for Tashkent's perspective.
No, thank you. And I'll mention, we're going to go to Kazakhstan in just a second, but I'll mention too that Kyrgyzstan is also looking into this small reactor. They don't have as many details as the Uzbek one, where we know that they're going to build 655 megawatt units and put them in Uzbekistan, which is also a very low number, as I said, you know, but you can get solar and wind and generate that much electricity, but they chose the nuclear. Asel, you talked a little bit about the fact that there's about to be a referendum, and they're looking at, well, are they going to build this or not? Although it seems almost certain that this referendum will pass. What does Rosatom have to offer Kazakhstan, and if you could talk a little bit about Rosatom's unique position in Kazakhstan, because they've been working with Kazatomprom for, you know, 20 years.
Sure. Well, basically, most of the bids are centering on building nuclear reactors that are 1,200. What are these? I don't really remember what the measuring, but it's megawatts, no? gigawatts.
Yeah, no, megawatts. That's it. 1,200
megawatts. Yes. 1,200 megawatts. And the idea here is that the Korean, for example, the South Korean company suggested that, the French company suggested that, whatever became after Areva, I don't remember the name, and the Japanese also. The Russians are also operating within that limit of 1,200, but the problem with that, and I think Mukhtar Jakishev, the former director of Kazatomprom, has actually stated very clearly that in case, for example, that energy needs to go back into the grid, right? In case, for example, there is no consumption and it needs to go back into the grid, the energy system that this particular nuclear power plant is getting into cannot sustain more than 800 megawatts of energy. So that surplus can potentially needs to be used somewhere. And needs to be utilized. So that's the main problem with all the bids so far. Nobody really considered the operational possibility of the energy grid that actually is existing in the country. Obviously Russia does have a much kind of an upper hand in all the bids. And that's because not only of the historical, so to say, even family ties, right, between Rosatomprom and Kazatomprom. The head, the former chair of the Kazatomprom, for example, had a son-in-law on board of the Rosatomprom. So it's been a very let's say, close cooperation among the elites. But it's not only that. Russia today, for example, Rosatomprom has a very strong control over uranium production. So in that sense, it would be natural for Rosatomprom, taking all the corruption scandals and so on aside, but it will be natural for Rosatomprom to be interested in constructing the power plant because it can potentially just represent a very easy, geographically proximate, so to say, part of a chain, part of the production chain. So Russia can potentially extract the uranium from Kazakhstan, process it in Russia, and then bring it back to the nuclear power plant that it will service. So that particular close cooperation, and Kazakhstan already supplies and processes most of the uranium from the country in Russia. So it's natural for that type of economic relations to persist and then materialize in the nuclear power plant. Whether or not we need nuclear power plant is a completely different story. Although it seems, and I agree with Bruce, that the decision seems to be been made already, and the referendum is not going to make a difference. A government already spent over half a million, I think, 500 million on promoting the referendum. And it's just the beginning. I think the money is probably going to increase in a month. So it's going to be, it seems like it's going to be a done deal. One intrigue, though, with the Rosatomprom is that Kazakhstan in the government still cooperates and negotiates with the Chinese companies as well. So there may be a possibility for Chinese bid to come into the picture. And then how that will change the dynamics and who will actually be responsible for the construction still remains intriguing and not necessarily 100% done deal.
Okay, thank you. I should mention too that, of course, Kazakhstan and Russia are co-owners, with Russia being the majority owner of this uranium enrichment center in Angarsk in southern Siberia too. So they have that long history also, which might give Russia something of an edge. We still have a lot to go through, so I want to make sure we get into transportation, because this is something else where Russia's kind of made a strong, lately, some progress on that. And we know everyone's been talking about the Middle Corridor, the way to link China and Europe through Central Asia and the Southern Caucasus. And now Russia is pitching this other, they have their own counter version of this too. They know that the Central Asians want to trade, of course, with India. That's the big goal. Even talk about railway through Afghanistan, which is a long shot, but Russia's really pressing this north-south corridor, and they already have involved Central Asian countries in this. So Fran, can you tell me about the north-south corridor runs on both sides of the Caspian, but can you tell me about the one that runs through Central Asia that Russia's promoting right now and signing deals for?
Yes, indeed. So let's say the eastern branch of the north-south corridor needs and goes through Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan. So it's through railways. Now both countries, I mean, it's been going on for a while, but there's been new developments there. Even from the Turkmen side, they're building new infrastructure to support this, and they're talking with the Kazakh officials for the border crossings. So the idea is for the cargo, well, it will go both ways, but going from Russia, it goes through Kazakhstan, it goes through Turkmenistan, then it goes through Iran, and then from Iran to the Chabahar port in the Persian Gulf, and then onwards to mostly India, but it could go to other Gulf countries. It will depend. I mean, it just depends what the goods are. But it's clear, like you mentioned, there's lots of talk about the middle corridor, because, of course, it involves Europe, it involves China. But there's not so much noise about the north-south corridor. But at the end of the day, what this turns Central Asia, you know, going back to cliches, but it's really the crossroads, because you have the east-west routes and you have north-south routes going through the region. And, you know, the gateway in this sense to Iran and from Iran to the Gulf, it continues to be Turkmenistan. Of course, from a Caspian perspective, it's there because of the ports and the capacities is a bit of a different story. It doesn't work out that well. So it will still depend on rail for the most part. But it's definitely an interest from Moscow to increase its transportation links with India as well. You know, it's probably it's not a consequence of the Ukrainian war directly, but it's definitely been fostered and helped out this renewed interest in this route from the conflict and Russia's positioning there. So we see also some deals also with Uzbekistan and so on for agriculture produce going north to Russia. So I mean there are other links to this north-south corridor, but the main one is the one that goes through Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan in this sense.
Okay, thank you. Timur, I was wondering, did you notice when the Russian Prime Minister was just in Uzbekistan, he was also part of the topics were strengthening railroad ties. He spoke specifically about the Agro Express. We know that Uzbekistan and Russia are already connected by railway, but is this an example of Russia trying to either remind or advertise the fact that it's still got these railway connections as an export-import? Or is there even a need to do that with Uzbekistan?
I mean, honestly, I hate to say that, but I'm always pessimistic about any big projects that Russia is talking about lately. If you would listen to Russian officials, there are so many different huge projects that they're building. It's like I don't know, it's like China's Belt and Road, but Russia's version of it. You have the route, the north-south route, you have the Agro Express to Uzbekistan, all of the routes through South Caucasus, through with Afghanistan. Russia is also talking about increasing cooperation and connections with India. So there are so many plans, but I doubt that we will see any realization of any of those projects because, first of all, this is not, an easy part of the world where you can just build another railway or another route. If we talk about, for example, Iran or if we talk about Afghanistan, right? Second of all, Russia doesn't have money. All of the money that Russia has goes to the war in Ukraine and everything related to that to keep the Russian economy stable. Russia doesn't have a surplus of money to spend on infrastructure building in other places around the world. Russia doesn't really have the money for building infrastructure inside of its own territory. So honestly, I think all of the talks that we hear from Mishustin, from Putin himself, or from other officials, they are just talks that don't necessarily have a chance to become a reality, in my view.
Okay, thank you. I am aware of the time and that you're busy people, so we'll get to the last point in this program. You know, at the intro, I suggested that Russia has enjoyed some success in these recent projects with the Central Asians, and you could certainly make that argument. Again, they have gas contracts with Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan that extend through 2040. If they're going to build a small nuclear power plant in Uzbekistan, there's a chance they're going to build a nuclear power plant in Kazakhstan and also a small nuclear power plant in Kyrgyzstan. The railway connections, these are long-term projects. I mean, these are things that they're in for, that the partnership will be dealing with for years. Certainly in the case of nuclear, this is a decades-long relationship that they're getting into. Has Russia been able to solidify its position through these deals? Is it becoming indispensable, certainly in the energy sector, to Central Asia with its recent moves? And I'll start with you, Asel.
Well, I would basically separate my forecast into short-term versus long-term. In the short-term, obviously, Russian involvement in the energy sector today is very strong. It does have the possibilities of putting a strong foundation and control over strategic infrastructure long-term. But at the same time, as Timur already said, that it's a big question whether or not these projects are going to be fulfilled in practice. I'm more not necessarily optimistic, but in a sense that I do see much more real commitment from both Russia and Iran regarding the North-South corridor. Then Timur, for example, I mean, they have actually engaged in reconstructing each other's ports, and they have signed, for example, agreements with Azerbaijan as well, and so on. So that part of the route seems to be much more solid. But that can obviously change if war in Ukraine ends, for example. Then the entire game may be altered as well, and the incentives may change too, so that the Russian involvement in energy sector may not necessarily be as required or needed in the long term. But yes, you can make I think we can make a very strong statement that yes, in the short run, Russia recently has actually increased its control over energy sector in Central Asia, but the long-term goals remain to be seen.
Okay, thank you. Fran, are they able to sit back in the Kremlin right now and look at Central Asia and go, they're not going anywhere anytime soon?
Well, I mean, they're still going to be there. They're not going anywhere anytime soon. No, from what you mean, I mean that the ties, generally speaking, the ties will remain there, despite even if these developments that we mentioned in the energy sector, mostly, but also in transit, did not happen. You know, they would still be have very close ties. So, I mean, this has increased them in the short term, like Castle said. I mean, the gas deals, for example, the gas exports to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, they're short term, right? They're just a consequence of the war in Ukraine. If Russia was exporting at full capacity to Europe, this probably would have not happened, right? So that's a direct consequence of that. So it's not it doesn't respond to a strategic vision, but to a tactical need. Let's put it like this. Now, even if the deals go to some of these deals with Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan go to 2040, I think that the greatest uncertainty is not that the people in the Kremlin say Central Asia is not going anywhere, we've got them, but it's the other way around, right? What's going to happen with Russia? Because I think that's a great uncertainty, and that's going to define whether this is going for the long term or not. Because, you know, who knows when the war in Ukraine will end, how will it end, what's going to happen within Russia in the coming decades. I mean, Putin is not a young man. So I think there's the great question mark hangs over Russia, and this will influence whether these things are long term or short term. Some are clearly short term and tactical. Others, yeah, the nuclear energy, but still we need to put things in perspective, right? Even the six reactors for Uzbekistan, they produce 330 megawatts. Like the average U.S. Nuclear plants produce 1,000, right? So there's still important inroads, but they're still in the grand scheme of things, they're still not large. For gas, again, it might be a bit different, but it's just more short term. So yeah, it's hard to, you know, we don't have a crystal ball. It's hard to say. But of course, they're probably more relaxed in that sense than they were 2 years ago, just after the invasion. See that they still have these links and they're increasing them in some aspects. But I wouldn't take things for granted, basically because we don't know what's going to happen in Russia in the next 5-10 years.
Okay, thank you. Tamar, you know, during 2022, the first year of this war, and you'd written about this when it was going on, that, you know, Putin visited all the Central Asian countries. I mean, you can really sense that there was some worry there in Moscow that they were losing out to a lot of people. Now, there have been projects, you know, for Arab countries. Other countries have come in and they want to build wind, they want to build solar, they want to do green hydrogen. All these people have shown up with this stuff. Has Russia been able to solidify its position with these energy deals, recent energy deals in Central Asia, where they can feel a little bit easier about Central Asia not leaving and going in some different direction and Russia being a secondary partner?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I think if you ask me, did Russia solidify its positioning in Central Asia through the recent activities for the last 2.5 years? I would say not exactly. I would say Russia's position has already been solidified in Central Asia. What we see today, everything what Russia is doing in the region, it is mostly a heritage of the Soviet Union. You know, you take any of the cooperation direction that we've discussed today, gas, it's possible because during Soviet Union, there was built a pipeline. We're talking about railway connection. Yeah, again, it's because during Soviet Union, everything was centralized and railways were from Central Asia directed towards Moscow. We're talking about, we didn't touch upon migration, but migration is also something that is in part the heritage of the Soviet Union. Nuclear energy, it's also something that Russia inherited from the Soviet Union and uses it as a tool to be, you know, up to date in at least this part of the technological development in the world. So Russia has already been for years a, you know, have had its position solidified in Central Asia, and it will not disappear overnight. It will not disappear maybe in even 10 years. We're not even discussing the ties that exist between the political elites, the nature of authoritarian regimes that we have that brings those countries together. So I think we're going to be seeing Russia having a very strong position in Central Asia for a long time in the future. However, it doesn't mean necessarily that Central Asia in this context doesn't have a capacity to make its own decisions, or that some of the decisions that Central Asia is making that can be interpreted as pro-Russian is not necessarily decisions that are taken by Moscow for Central Asia. So I would say that in the long term, we will see that Russia will be very important for Central Asia, but with every year and with every another aggression of Russia or any act of Russia that will further drive Russia into isolation, Central Asia will be depending on Russia less and less, but it doesn't mean that it will happen overnight.
Okay, great. Thank you. You know, real quick, if I missed something and someone wants to make a point, this is your chance. Okay, Brian?
Yeah, just no. I mean, I really agree with Timur's point there. Migration is an aspect that is quite important. That there've been also some movements there, but not necessarily on the right end in the sense of promoting migration, but quite on the contrary. And you've covered this in other episodes of the Majlis podcast. But it goes actually the other way around. So it's not just all going in one direction, but there's different moments where some aspects there might be a strong collaboration, others quite the opposite. So that's also something to look out for.
Okay, thank you.
And I would also like to add that if we take, I agree with Timur's comment that yes, Russia has been there, a formidable, so to say, partner. And it does have the it does use the legacy of the Soviet Union quite smartly in a way. But what I've seen in the past 2 years is that Russian presence in strategic infrastructure, particularly electricity, energy, gas, and so on, has been increasing. And I think it's been increasing because, again, it has the surplus that it wants to put somewhere. It also has the investments and the money. Not necessarily a lot of investments and a lot of money, but to use it strategically so that certain aspects of energy production will remain tied to Russia. So we do see a kind of in the short run, I think in the short term, we do see a stronger interest and stronger presence of Russia in strategic energy infrastructures of Central Asian countries. And whether or not this has been, so to say, moved by Russia with a fist or established because Russia has an influence or not is another question. I do agree with the fact that, yes, Central Asian states do have agency and their own, so to say, logic. And that logic may not necessarily be always squared within the state interests, but the regime interests. So looking through that perspective of whether or not certain projects are good for the people in power, for specific elites in power, is a very useful lens to understand where the agency comes from and how it translates into certain political deals, economic deals, and overall politics on the ground.
Okay, thank you very much. And we have come to the end of the program. So thank you, Fran, Asel, and Timur for being on the program. Big thanks, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Majlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Majlis podcast or the Central Asian Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thanks, and we'll be back soon. Bye-bye.